Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
The Prums are one of the oldest wine families in Germany's picturesque Middle Mosel region. The family business, J.J. Prum, is now run by Katharina Prum, a charming, talented and highly amusing woman. Listen to us chat about tradition, Fortnum & Mason and Oklahoma, the differences between the estate's two great vineyards, Wehlener Sonnenuhr and Grachel Himmelreich, and the eternal beauty of Riesling. Hi, Katharina. How are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm fine. Thank you. Good to see you.
And you. And you're in Germany, aren't you? Lucky person, you're in the middle Mosel.
I am. View to the Mosel River and the vineyards.
One of the most beautiful views in the world. I mean, you wake up every morning looking at that.
Yes. Yes. And we're more aware of it, and it gets more obvious when we have people visiting and they enjoy the view. So for us, it's normal. Yeah. But we don't complain, so it's a pretty nice view.
What do people say when they see that for the first time? They don't say anything, do they?
Almost everybody says how beautiful it is, and most also say they did not expect it to be that impressive, and the vineyards being that steep. Even if you have seen a lot of pictures, it's not the same experience compared to being here.
Because the slope, some of them is like 70%, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you must have very strong legs, have you?
Yes, of course.
Walking up and down the hills. Let's talk about the Prums. I mean, this unbelievable family. How many generations do you go back? Do you know when the Prums were first turned up in the Middle Mosel?
That's a little bit difficult to say. So some numbers are mentioned, including 1156, but we have no proof for that. But what we know for sure is that we can trace our family's history back to the 18th century. Mm. Probably it's a few generations or even centuries more. Mm. But we have not had anybody to really dig in the archives and find the proofs for it.
And find it. Yeah. And were the Prums always in wine, or were they in agriculture generally, or did they do something else?
No, they have not always been in wine, but always. The majority of vineyards were owned by the church here in the region, as many other regions.
Yeah.
So they say that the family was involved, or some members, even before we owned vineyards, kind of as consultants or these kind of things. There is also quite a law history in the family. So they say that also a lot of our ancestors have been lawyers.
Ah.
But since the early 19th century, we own a good and increasing portion of the vineyards here in that area.
And J.J. Prum, which is your bit of the Prums, as it were, was founded in 1911, I think, by your great-grandfather, who was Johann Josef Prum, hence J.J. Prum. Why was the Prum holding? Because there was originally an S.A. Prum, wasn't it? Why was S.A. Prum split up?
So S.A. Prum was the first kind of the founding member of the original estate in the early 19th century, when Napoleon, who of course is a very controversial personality, but we see a lot of positive sides of his work. So he came, and as in a lot of other regions, he decided the church should have less influence, and families could buy the vineyards. So he started the estate in the early 19th century. He had, I think, five or six brothers. They all did not marry. He had, I think, six sons, out of which only one married. So that meant the original estate that he started could be kept in one hand, which was a very unusual thing. And then again, the second youngest son had three sons, I think, and four daughters. And when he died in the late 19th century, the original estate that could be kept in one hand for two generations separated and kind of finished. the seven children each got one share, and J.J. Prum was the oldest son.
Yeah.
So he got 1/7 originally. He bought vineyards from siblings, and then he expanded the estate.
Okay, and you were born in Bencastle, I think, weren't you, which is not so far away.
True.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was your life kind of full of wine from the start? Can you share your earliest wine memory with us?
No, I think if you grow up in a wine estate, it's more difficult to share the first wine experience compared to, I met a lot of people who said their first wine experience was one of our wines, and our wines made them get interested in the topic of wines in general. For me, it's more difficult because, you grow up in a wine estate. We actually lived in the house, so you're surrounded by it. And I could not mention a specific date when I tried the wine first. I, of course, remember as a smaller child, we were allowed to dig the finger into the wine and then maybe two different glasses and give a comment which one we preferred and why we preferred it. I also could not really tell you when I had my first full glass of wine, but it was a step-by-step process.
And it was a Prum. It was a Prum wine, I hope, wasn't it?
Yes, of course.
And I've read a description of your childhood. You said it was unquiet, noisy, in other words. Why was it noisy? Was that your dad?
Yes, I think I mentioned it in I don't know which interview, but what I was saying by this was that we grew up in the estate, and so we were surrounded by it, and we were surrounded by the business. So there was no, you live in a private home, daddy works during the day, he comes home during the evening, and then you have your quiet time. Mm. We lived in the business, which meant sometimes 24 hours, 7 days a week business. In those times also, there was no email, so almost everything was done by telephone. Mm. And my father had the attitude that he said, well, you need to be available almost all the time.
He always answered the phone in case it was a sale.
Right? Yes, exactly, and he did it himself.
Yeah.
And be it Saturday night at 7 o'clock or Sunday morning at 8 or whatever. So that is what I meant, for me, was a big playground also, but it was not really a quiet private home.
Yeah. And in 1997, when I think you were about 18, you went to the UK and you worked in an art gallery, you worked for a wine merchant, you worked for Fortnum & Mason. I'm sure you were busy perfecting your incredible English, but was that you being a bit independent and saying, hey, I want my life in a way?
Yes. And I had no idea what to do with the rest of my life. I knew I did not want studying at Geisenheim, which my parents not really expected from me, but a lot of visitors and customers. So
Geisenheim is a wine university in Germany.
Exactly.
Really,
So that was what many people asked me: when will you start this German wine university? Because they expected this is the only path you can go in my role. Mm. I found that question and that assumption not very nice and rather maybe not intimidating, but not also, I did not agree to this path or this idea. And I said, okay, I have to go away. I wanted to go to other countries and get some experiences. And I was thinking about different things, and then I landed up in London. So indeed, it was testing some freedom and getting some experience and trying some different things. And for quite a while, I was not at all sure where I would land up eventually.
I mean, you studied law, didn't you, in Munster rather than winemaking, as you said. So had you decided you definitely didn't want to work in the family business? Did you think, I'm going to be a lawyer? I mean, you said some of your ancestors were lawyers as well.
No, yes, correct, including my father.
Mm. Oh, your father's a lawyer.
My father's a lawyer, and the reason why he started was, or the path, how he got there was quite a little bit different. In his case, his parents did not think he should do it, whereas my father, I had a lot of different ideas what to do. I was considering business, medicine, law, thousands of different things. So he said, okay, you do what you want, but don't do what we call in German brotlose Kunst, like study
what
art.
What a fantastic word.
That was his idea. So
what does that mean? Study the art. Study art. Say that word again.
Like that. So,
say it again.
Breadless art. So something where you have really not a high chance to have
bread losing. Is it? What's the word again? Say it again.
Brotlose.
Brotlose. Losing bread.
It means like you hardly can survive. So you have no perspective. So, but then he said, okay, he went to law school and he was very happy about that experience. So if you do something, maybe why don't you try law? And I was thinking back and forth. And then at the end, I said, okay, why don't start it? Without really saying I'm determined to become a lawyer or and determined to become a judge or whatever. But to experience something properly and to try something non-wine related.
And you studied in Spain, didn't you, a little bit? And then you did an internship in Oklahoma, of all places in the States.
Yes.
And is that when you started to get kind of drawn back into the family business, in a sense? I've read that that was true.
Yeah. So when I had decided to do law, I wanted to do some international thing. And there were three universities in Germany that offered a special program on Anglo-American law, which I found very different or difficult, interesting and
difficult.
Yeah, difficult but challenging. And yeah. I was curious about it because it's a very different idea of law, often resulting in the same decisions. And I was very, very interested in doing something international. And in this, so I opted for Münster, which is kind of halfway between here and Hamburg, so more northern Germany. And in that context, I needed to do an internship in the US. My father, of course, since we had a lot of customers and contacts in the US, asked different distributors, importers, wine merchants. And in the end, I landed in Oklahoma, because I opted for this and not for a big law firm in New York or San Francisco, because I found it more interesting to be in a law firm that's very small, where you are not just the person to prepare the coffee for maybe get some mails to the mailbox. And so I landed up there. It was very nice experience, because they all took very much care of me. And yes, in this context, it was the first time I traveled to the US. I was 20 years old then. Since they had offered us this contact to the law firm, they said, okay, now somebody of the family is in this market. Can she do some tastings with me or with us? And there were some, like, of the German Wine Institute tastings in New York and San Francisco, Chicago. So can she do that? And I found it very exciting, because I was very young and I had never traveled in the US, so it gave me the opportunity to go to this big
school. So you got drawn back in, did you?
Exactly. And I was just standing there, and a lot of people came and asked me questions about the wines and told me how much they admire the wines and since how many decades they drink them and which was their first vintage and why and how they came here as a student and whatever, bought the 2 cases of 71 vintage and still have some, and really beautiful stories. And it gave me indeed a different perspective to the whole thing, because I had grown up here, and of course it was nice, but as a child, you see it in a completely different way.
And you were taking it for granted in a way.
Exactly. Yeah? And this way, you see more the work. That's what I now observe with my children. It's a lot of work. You need to really be very committed. It's a lot of different things to do, and it never stops. And maybe you see that part. And of course, as a young child, you don't drink the wine, so you don't appreciate the beauty and
the best bit. tell us a bit about your dad, Manfred. I mean, he's something of a Mosel legend. Just what makes him so good at what he does? And I just wonder how much he's passed on to you, in a sense.
I think he was always and is very, very, very quality oriented without any compromises. And he always said you have to be very detailed and you have to do the things you do properly. So in Germany, you say you have to do it ordentlich. So means you really have to be very detailed, don't overlook small things, and be behind it nonstop. I think that's the key thing, to be this detailed orientation and no compromises.
Is that you as well?
Yes, we are very, very different personalities, but I think that is something, I think you need to do. You need to be like that.
I mean, you've been pretty much full time at the winery, I think, since about 2006. I mean, have you changed anything? I mean, or is it better to just, you've had this, you know, it's a traditional winery in many ways.
Yeah.
Is it better to just leave a winning formula as it is and just keep doing what you've been doing for a long time?
Yeah. So there are, of course, different aspects in a winery. It's the production and it's the administration and sales, which are, they all are linked together, but they are all different areas. I invested a lot of time in the sales administration. Actually, I told you before how life was as when I was a young child. So it was in many aspects a one-man show when I was a child, so when my father was only around. We have a much bigger team here in different areas. We have kind of sales team. Before that, we worked through exporters, so we did not know as well how our wines went, how the wines are sold. So that's something we are much deeper in now. So this area I did a lot, and that was my start, because there I found there was the most potential to develop. And my father did not like to travel, and he was more focusing on the production, which is very important, but the sales and communication is also essential. In the production, yes, of course, you always have to change things, but it's not, the approach has never been, and neither with my father or grandfather nor with me, to change something just for the sake of change, but rather constantly thinking, and that's also something my father gave me as an important lesson. You always have to continue thinking, what can we do better? How can we do better in little details? And never kind of a revolution, but rather an evolution in little things. And that's a process that has always continued and has to continue in the future as well.
I mean, I was reading up on you in a book, described you as the winery as epitomizing the culture and conservatism of the Mosel Valley. Do you think that is that a fair description? Would you say you're conservative? I don't mean you personally, but the winery.
Yeah, I mean, of course, now we could have a long talk about conservatism. yes, and I would not, at least not contradict. I think we have always stick to really, we try to dig to get as close to the core of the model as possible, to be as authentic as possible. That's a key aspect for me, to really, we don't have an idea of a wine in our head. We really try to understand this piece of land as good as possible. And of course, it changes also, climate changes. So to really understand what is of nature offering us and how can we get this as authentic as possible into the bottle. That's maybe the key job we have to
do. I think that's a great thing to live by, isn't it, as a winery. Some of the people listening to this podcast will never have visited the Mosel Valley, poor them, because we said it's one of the most beautiful wine regions on earth. Can you just tell us a bit about the climate and the terroir and the main differences maybe between the lower, the middle where you are and the upper Mosel? Just give us a kind of quick overview of where you are and what are the main climatic influences.
So in general, the Mosel is still one of the coolest climates in Europe, if we exclude the UK, for example.
Thank you.
Which I'm more impressed of the products.
Good.
From there.
That'll make you sell even more wine in England.
But so it's relatively still cool. Rather long, slow ripening period. Harvests are getting earlier, but it's still mid-harvest. It's the earliest we've ever had a harvest to start. Yes, you can differentiate between lower, middle, and upper Mosel. And then, of course, the Saar and Ruwer, which are the same region. But it's a little bit difficult to differentiate just in these aspects, because even here, if you see the 5-kilometer radius, you have a lot of differences, and maybe we'll get into the differences of the vineyards deeper. So the lower Mosel, for example, is a little bit warmer still. You get different styles of wines, but it's really difficult to give general statements. So it's more by village. Sometimes the side of the river makes a difference, but it's important to be aware of the big differences between different parts of the Mosel.
More vineyards and the dominant soil type is slate, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. The weathered, we call it gray, colleagues call it blue. Slate is what is the slate we have here in all of our vineyards. And it's this gray. So you also find the what they call red slate, which has some volcanic influence that you don't find in this particular area we work in. And the slate is a very, very key aspect for us in many aspects.
Let's drill down into the vineyards a bit, because you've got some of the best sites in Germany, most notably Wehlener Sonnenuhr, yeah, and Grache Himmelreich, which are your two kind of crew or Grand Cru, we could say, really. What makes them so different? Is it soil aspect, altitude, vine age? Just tell us a little bit about those two sites, because they're so fascinating and so different, aren't they?
So those who haven't been here, maybe I should explain, they are in the same slope, immediate neighbors, so side by side. If you look at them from the estate, for example, you could see both. You hardly understand the difference. So they are both steep. They are the same soil type. So it's this gray weathered slate. However, there are little nuances in that I think only the Riesling grape can express, and maybe it's a little bit similar to the Pinot Noir grape in Burgundy. You have the same phenomena. So it's the exposition, it's the soil structure, meaning topsoil versus slate rock. It's the water supply. The altitude is more or less the same. Average age of vine average is also the same. It varies a little bit from parcel to parcel, but there's no significant difference, which I would mention as a key aspect to differentiate between the vineyards. So it's really more the water supply, the sun exposition, the top, so the structure of the soil.
And they do make very different wines, don't they?
Yes,
I mean, how would you describe the difference?
Yes, and it's a phenomena every year again to observe the differences, even if it's parcels that are very, very close to each other.
And do you have some customers who like Wehlener Sonnenuhr more and others who like Grache Himmelreich?
Absolutely. Yeah. and very convinced about it. And even if we do a tasting with private customers who are not that experienced and maybe not that prejudiced, there's never a vote only for the one or the other. It's always those who say Wien is always better, very convinced, and others say, oh, I prefer Grach because whatever, it's a little bit more racy, it's a little bit more fresh in their opinion. I love both, of course, equally.
I love both.
I'm happy about not everybody agreeing on one vineyard.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And I think 2/3 of your vines are ungrafted, right? I mean, have you ever worried about phylloxera? And also, I wonder, you know, do ungrafted and grafted vines give you different qualities in a sense of grapes?
So actually, it's even more. It's about 90% ungrafted. Phylloxera is a topic, yes. It has never been a key topic, obviously, otherwise we would not talk about this high percentage of ungrafted vines. Phylloxera does not like slate specifically, so that's why I think you also find slate or volcanic soils, so that's why you also find ungrafted vines or sand, those three.
Sand it hates, yeah.
Slate and volcanic soils. So you find for ungrafted vines here quite a big amount overall, but in our estate particularly, because we always were very keen on having and keeping as many as possible. You find some in Spain, you find some on the Canary Islands. It's a topic we discuss a lot. What is the difference between grafted and ungrafted, and is it really so much better? We are observing, it's usually not possible to do the perfect research about it because you either have an ungrafted parcel or grafted. We have one case where we, and then you have different clones, your different vine age. So it's just, we think they age or they mature better and they have a more constant growing season. And especially just before and during harvest, there's more consistency in ungrafted vines than in grafted. So we sometimes have the impression that if you have a grafted vine, the grapes have a smaller period for the perfect picking time. So they either still need a few days to get the right ripeness, or maybe if you wait a day or two too long, you maybe get over that ideal point, which is still okay, but maybe they're not in a perfect shape any longer. It's not very scientific, but that's what we observe.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned a little bit about how you adapt to the seasons, and obviously, you know, increasing all of us are living with global warming. Is it altering the style of your wines? I mean, you said at the beginning the Mosel is one of the coldest wine, top wine producing regions in the world. I just wonder, you know, does botrytis still occur as regularly? And I'm thinking of a very hot vintage like 2022, which was, I think, unprecedented, wasn't it, in the Mosel?
Yes. So, botrytis, yes, it happens. We've had it slightly less in the last, in 22 and 21.
Yeah.
In 23, again, we had more. So I would not say in general the chances to produce botrytis wines are getting less. Ice wine seems to be a much rarer chance, but for botrytis, no. 22 was an extreme experience, yes. Mm. Not so much because we did not have a lot of botrytis, because that's something we like to take, but it's not our main goal to harvest as much botrytis as possible. But the dryness we had in 22 was really extreme and concerning. It was the first time I was really concerned about the vineyards and about the vines. I grew up with my father saying, "Don't worry, the Mosel has never too little humidity. We have the best slopes here and there's always enough." And I believed that until 22. I was really worried. And what we had to do is cut off a lot of grapes to de-stress the vines, both to guarantee the quality of the vintage and also to keep the long-term health of the vines. And that we have never done before in that extent.
Wow. And that's like a green harvest in a way, was it? Yeah.
And green we sometimes do, but in a rather moderate amount. Mm. We are not such big fans because it equally causes an imbalance to the vine.
Yeah.
And it's we prefer to regulate the yields at the pruning point rather than later.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about your approach in the cellar. I mean, are all the wines made in the same way?
Yes.
I mean, obviously not the botrytis affected wines, that'd be different, but you know.
Actually, even the botrytis wines are made the same way. Mm. They are all fermented with wild yeast. They are all vinified and aged in stainless steel. And the idea is always as little intervention as possible, coming back to the point, as much authenticity as possible. So the product that is produced in the vineyards and ideal harvested at the perfect time should land in the bottle as authentic as possible with as little interference.
So no wood at all, even right. Big foudre. The right. Whole thing is stainless steel.
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. So that's about as direct as you can get.
Yes.
An experience of what the vineyard tastes like, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you only work with Riesling, yeah?
Correct.
Just tell us what you like most about the variety. Is there anything that's difficult about Riesling? I mean, selling it sometimes can be difficult, maybe not for you, but I think some people find it hard. But what do you like most about Riesling as a variety when you're working with it and tasting it?
I could not really say that there's anything I do not like about it. I think it's the perfect grape for this area. I love it because it's very, very sensitive and very, very versatile. It expresses the soil, the weather, the year, all the conditions you find by nature. Mm. Very, very authentic. That's why every year is very different. Mm. Even every parcel is different. And I like this sensitivity a lot. I think it's very interesting and it makes the wine production never boring. So it's one grape varietal, but it has so many faces every year. And then, of course, comparing different years, that's a fascinating aspect. And of course, how well it ages.
Yeah.
That's another beauty. And of course, then with food pairing, I think it's one of the, if not the most versatile grape varietal for food pairing internationally.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, what's the oldest Prüm wine you've had?
A 21 Auslese.
And still alive?
Yeah, so last time was a couple of years ago, yes.
Yeah.
Rather dry tasting, but still very alive.
I mean, they're indestructible, aren't they? I mean, I often think I taste one of your wines and it's a 2010 or something, and it feels, you show it to somebody blind and they say, "Oh, what's, how old is that? 3 years old or something?" And it turns out it's 14.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, Riesling generally comes first or second when wine professionals name their favorite white varieties. You know, it might be Chardonnay, it might be Riesling, it might be maybe Chenin Blanc, I don't know. But I think consumers often struggle to understand it, don't they? How can we get more people drinking Riesling. I mean, I don't think Prüm has any problem selling its wine, but it'd be nice if we could get more enthusiasm around Riesling. How do you think we can do that? You must think about it, don't you?
No, I think we are on a good way to start with the positive thing. I think what we observe is that the younger generation is more open-minded in trying things without being prejudiced by something they heard before. Mm-hmm. Let's say if it's a wine that has a certain sweetness as ours, they don't mind trying something like this and don't have this general objection against sweet wines or something sweet. What we need to do as growers, I think, is be more clear in defining. Let's talk about the predicate wines like Cabernet, Spätlese, Auslese. How do we define the tasting profile? Mm-hmm. So we as an estate, for us, it's very important to be very clear in the profile. And a Cabernet needs to taste like a Cabernet, delicate, really more the dry than the sweet wine. Mm-hmm. If it's a super hot year with just not allowing this point harvesting point of a cabinet, we would rather skip the predicate than declassifying Auslese to a cabinet. I think you have to be very disciplined in how you interpret the predicates, for example, and you have to be consistent in that. We have a German wine law. We have some classifications in parts. They do not correspond. At the moment, we are trying to get this into one, but it's very difficult because there are a lot of different groups of interest. You have the top growers, then you have the more mass producers who have a very different approach. So I think that is something we could do better, but it's more the labeling than the wines itself. I think also maybe there are quite some growers who love doing what they do and they do fantastic wines, but maybe they don't think enough about the international consumer who's confronted with a lot of different wines and still wants to understand what he's drinking or she.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you said this, that almost all the wines you make are off-dried, semi-sweet or sweet. I have to add that they're delicious. And I think that balance between sugar and acidity, people often misunderstand. You say to somebody, this has got, you know, 25 grams of residual sugar, and they go, God, that's so sweet. And then you give it to them and they think, wow, you know, it's actually balanced. I mean, there's been a big movement in Germany, as I'm sure you know, towards drier styles. I mean, you know, in the Mosel to a degree, but more in other regions, you know, the Pfalz and the Rheingau and stuff, since what, the 1990s? I just wonder, has that affected you at all? Did you ever think, hey, we should make more dry wines?
So in general, I think it's a positive development, very positive. I think the international perception is maybe that there's even more than there actually is, because Mosel always has been a strong export market, whereas the others were less visible. So I think there's also just a question of visibility. But yes, there is more dry wine production, and I think it's a very good development, because there were too many not fantastic wines with residual sugar around. And I think you rather let the wine be dry than, if a wine has some little residual sugar left, it has to be really good. Otherwise, I would never drink it myself, for example. I think sweet wines not made in a good way are horrible. So I think if there's more concentration on dry, or if you find a predicate wine with some sweetness, if it has, it needs to be excellent, and then it's good. So I'm happy about the development.
Yeah.
It has not, I would say it has not influenced us for our wine production. I think the Mosel, with now the climate change and warmer climate, allows better dry wines to be produced. And I think there are fantastic wines around. And if we had too much vineyards, for example, I would happily, or too much wine, happily let some of them ferment through to be dry. But we have a very limited piece of land, and we have a lot of wine lovers that love our style, and it's a style that is unique in the world, whereas you can find and produce good dry Rieslings in many other regions. That's why we focus on it.
I think that's true. Please don't change.
I think you've found fantastic dry Rieslings.
Yeah, don't change, right? I mean, listen, Prüm was one of the founder members of the VDP, which is the Verband Deutscher Prädikatsweingüter. Just tell people a little bit about what that does. I mean, it's a kind of collection of the best, isn't it, pretty much?
So it was founded in the Mosel Valley by some top growers more than 100 years ago. The idea was let's form an association so that we can sell our production. So the key was, of course, you needed to have the same attitude towards quality. So only the top growers and the top wines. And it was kind of, yes, let's be together. Let's auction all the wines. So by that time, they met once a year to auction all their wines, originally in barrels. And that was their only sales. So it was a cooperation of, people that had the same quality philosophy and used their common platform to sell the wines.
But it's only in the Mosel, is it?
It started in the Mosel. And then there were also, I think, two more regional chapters founded in the Rheingau and Pfalz, I think.
Yeah.
And then later on, they became one big association all of Germany.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask you about, because I've experienced this, is there's no tasting room. There certainly wasn't at Prüm. And your dad, I know, discourages people from spitting out the wines. Can you ever see that change? It's kind of part of the experience of going to Prüm that your dad and probably you now open lots of bottles and you expect people to enjoy them on the spot, right?
Yeah. So my father will turn 90 this year and he's not holding a lot of tastings any longer. Yeah. But I'm still confronted with this story a lot. I know it's true to a good amount. I'm not sure if it's 100% true. Some stories I hear, like famous German sommeliers saying, well, I was here all alone as a young sommelier and I wanted to taste a few wines and I had to empty each bottle before trying the new one. So we do tastings eventually, not very often, because as you say, we don't have a visitor center or something. Yeah. But we do tastings. People don't have to empty the full bottle. But indeed, we don't like spitting a lot. And the general approach is, we don't produce the wines to be wasted. So it's limited. We put a lot of effort in it and want people to drink them and really enjoy them. This is the background. But no, you don't need to empty each bottle.
But if people come to you, expect them to drink them, not taste them.
Yes.
Well, they can taste them, but they're not allowed to spit them out.
It depends. But it's what many expect, and some are very relieved, and others look for the flower vases and for some escape. But actually, another reason I think that's important, and many people know, but not everybody, is we have low alcohol levels. So they range between 7 and 9, 9.5%. Yeah. So it's a different thing than if you go to a tasting with 14-15%.
It's not Chateauneuf du Pape.
As you know, the predicate wines are all non-chaptalized. That's actually also a founding idea of the VDP. Mm. So no chaptalization. It's really the pure grape juice being fermented into a wine. And this is something that is still very important for us as an idea. And it also guarantees lower
good. I like that.
Super alcohol levels.
This the one of many good things about Prüm. You can drink more of it, right?
Yes. Just tell us. Never had enough. I hope.
No, you never had enough. Tell us a little bit about how you get away from wine. I know you've got two quite young children who wanted to sit in on the podcast today, didn't they? Do they leave you time for anything else? I mean, how do you like to get away from wine?
Yeah. So it's actually in a state like this, plus small children, it's difficult to find time. I hope I will find more in a couple of years. I like gardening a lot, so that's my little escape sometimes for half an hour. So I know you have the greatest garden culture in the UK. We've visited a few, but that's one of my dreams to do more, and we have a little garden behind the house. So that are my little escapes. I try to get the children there with limited success so far. Some sports like running, music. I like music a lot, classical music. But that's basic cooking. That's what I do. I like to cook almost every day.
Fantastic.
But that's it. I have a lot of more things I would love to do, but those need to wait a couple.
But I think we want you to stay focused, A, on your family and your children, but especially on this incredible jewel of an estate. Katerina, thank you so much for just sharing your passion for the family business. I'm so glad you didn't become a lawyer. I don't know
actually,
whether you
too,
are.
Although that would have been some fun too, but I don't complain.
I think
thank
it
you
would,
very much I, for having me.
I think it would have been a waste. And I'll see you very soon in the Mosel.
Great. Looking forward to it.
See ya.
Bye.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm glad that Caterina didn't stick with law. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the wine writer and presenter, Jancis Robinson, Master of Wine. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles, and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @TimAtkin, and on Instagram, @TimAtkinMW. See you next week.